What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. First, if you're first time listening, thanks for coming, but go follow me on Instagram because that's all I am at the moment. But I got something in the works to come back on the Twitter, so we'll see if that works. We'll try it in a few weeks. Let things cool down, you know, don't push our luck. But you can follow me at Conspiracy or JAC on Instagram. And once I make my miraculous respawn on Twitter, I'll post that as well. But I got a website, conspiracyorjustacoincidence.com. And if you want to support the show, you can support me through Patreon and through Venmo. It's at Conspiracy or JAC. And I also on my website, you can support me there as well, if that might be an easier place to do it. So Darcy, thank you. She was a huge supporter for Christmas, and that was such a nice gift. It means so much. Like, I get reviews and I love those too. And any financial support, it all means like so much, because I work so hard on this stuff. Like, I read constantly, do notes. Today I took off to do notes and things like that. So it just means so much. So thank you so much for supporting me. And it really means a lot. So, everyone, today's episode, we are going to be talking about our final installment of the serial killer saga. And just to like go listen to the other two episodes, because I think it was like super helpful and super interesting. But basically, to go over like what we talked about, there's so many consistent patterns with these people that are involved in the perpetrators, if you want to call them. They all come from troubled backgrounds, very troubling backgrounds, like prostitution as a mom. They were abused. They've seen abuse. They've been physically abused, sexually abused, all these things like that. They all have that. And then they also will be involved with cults that listen to the episodes. But basically, there's a pattern here that's a thread that is sewn through all of them. So we talked about that. We talked about how six serial killers within like 5 years all came from the same San Francisco area. You know, pretty crazy odds, if astronomical. We talked about globalization, how that increase of interaction with all nations led to an increased amount of people movement. I'm trying to get around censors because it seems like the world's gone insane. And so, you know, you understand what that means when I say people movement, that increased, just like how last episode we talked about in Mexico, right in Juarez, which is a huge drug pivotal location of the drug trade. This was opened up with American factories being promised they won't have to pay taxes and all this stuff like that. So they opened up these factories there just south of the border. And they employed these poor women in Mexico that were probably from villages. And these women would go, they would get their photos taken, not just like a headshot for their ID. They would get photos taken of full body shots and then put in a catalog. And you can imagine what that would be used for when the drug dealers or whoever powerful people come knocking and ask to look at their ID photos. You can understand where that would go around. The drug trafficking piece ties directly to the people movement piece. And also I talked about a lot about the CIA starting cults, and these cults and the serial killers often get trained with these cults or involved with these cults. And also another ties together is that the CIA teaches their people, they probably call them like defensive maneuvers, probably not defensive, but in their defensive maneuvers, they're taught how to either use weapons of opportunity, which means like you walk in and there's a lamp on the table, or they tell you to use a small caliber because that will bounce around inside the head and it's hard to identify the bullet. And so, which we find that most serial killers, even though they always have a profile, or they have a profile, oh, they only strangle them, or they only do this. It's obsessive, except many of them, all of them, never keep to this pattern that supposedly exists. And they often will utilize this small caliber execution style to the head. So it makes you wonder why are they both, and the mob also use the same tactics, which you can see where I'm going with this. Why is the CIA, is that just the most efficient way? Why are these people that have no ties to intelligence and military using the same, supposedly no ties, using the same tactics? So I was going to go into Charles Manson, but I've done shows on Charles Manson and everyone knows Charles Manson, and it's just exhausting to do it again. But just to show you the pattern exists with him as well. He's born of a teenage alcoholic prostitute, dressed up as a girl, as a child, just like Henry Lee Lucas, another serial killer. And also those, you ever seen that picture of Bill Gates? I should have put it on the slideshow, but the picture of Bill Gates where he's dressed in a dress at like a parade. And it just made me wonder, like, you know, this, whether that was like in the 60s or something, no father would dress their child in a skirt in the 60s. Like, that's weird. That's very weird. He went to juvie, then prison, found himself at Boys Town, which we talked about ad nauseum with the, oh my God, Franklin scandal. So just these ties, these consistent threads that keep going through. He was abused by guards and inmates. He found his way magically to California, the magic state, got charged with running a prostitution ring. And like Lucas, he begged the guards not to release him, because if you guys, I have a Manson episode. It was from Tom O'Neill's book. I think that's his book, Chaos. But basically Manson, just in this book, Program to Kill by David McGowan, he doesn't go into this because maybe he didn't have this evidence, but it's Manson the whole time. He gets released. He's arrested. He's on parole. He gets caught prostituting women. He gets caught robbery. He gets caught with drugs. He never gets put back in prison. Why? That makes zero sense. The guy has a rap sheet already by the time he's, you know, 18, so long, and he's violating parole and probation. They lock you up right away. Dude, I know, like, there's countless people sitting in county right now for violating, and they can be small violations. So you're letting this guy who's doing armed robberies, who has weapons that he's not allowed to have, and they don't put him back in jail? That doesn't make any sense unless there's a reason why. And the Tom O'Neill in that book, Chaos, he talks about how his probation officer or parole officer has ties. They got strong-armed by the FBI just to let it go. So that's all I'll say about Manson. But right when he comes out of prison, right when he comes out, he goes to California. He has this huge following of women, and they're obsessed with it. They listen to his every word. Is he that charismatic? He's so magnanimous, if that's the right word. He's so charismatic that he can, just wherever he walks, people flock to him and follow him. I don't think so. So here we go, continuing part three. So the mid-1970s is when the FBI Behavioral Sciences Unit came of age. And this is when the whole profiling of the serial killers entered the national lexicon. It became like the new American anti-hero. And we see that today. People love serial killers. I'm not like a true crime guy. Some people are, but it's everyone's obsessed with these people. And there's so many parallels, like I just said, between the killers. Kenneth Bianchi, this is Kenneth, I think. He was like Manson. He's born of an alcoholic teenage prostitute, forced to dress as a girl. So now that's three people: Henry Lee Lucas, Manson, and Bianchi. And he was taken while his mother was servicing tricks. And Ted Bundy's mom, also an abusive prostitute. So prostitution is this theme that runs rampant in serial killers' backgrounds. Why? Does that act solely make you into a killer? Or is there something more to that? And there's a large percentage of serial killer victims who are also prostitutes. So why is that? Many serial killers earn their living running their own prostitution rings. Gacy and Buono, he's going to be Bianchi's cousin, but they involved in kid rings. And both of these activities, murder, prostitution, they reek of mind control. The majority of prostitutes begin at an early age, first episode, Walled Off the Brain. What we talked about the first episode was how the brain is such an amazing organ or whatever you want to call it. It, when trauma happens to a little kid, they don't have this flee or fight or flee response. They get like stuck. So their brain, what they do is they wall off that moment, and it almost creates like a split person. So as long as they don't touch that moment, they seem relatively fine. But if you can activate that and bring that personality out that's created, that's how you get these multiple MPD, multiple personality disorder, which the government has studied extensively, as you can imagine. Hey, what's going on, dude? But yeah, so wall personality. So another reason behind this is because prostitutes and abused wives, there's that phenomena where they stay with the person, even though they're like literally being tortured. So a serial killer they pull from this area because their loyalty to like their handler, just like with an abused wife who keeps going back to their abusive husband. And they think like, oh, well, he cares about me, no one else. And they've kind of like brainwashed them into not going anywhere else. So that's why they pull from this group. Also, it's funny, is Bianchi, Bundy, Gacy all had like interaction or were involved with the police in like a good way, not being arrested. Like they were the reserves. They were working with the police. So why? What is the point of them? Why are they working with the police? Like these men are, and they, some of them have been killing at this point, but they still work with the police. So they also, which was very important, which is like so much what we're going through today. All these guys, these serial killers, they've had interactions with like depravities that one human, they've seen what one human can inflict on another. Some of them work at morgues or there are ambulance, and it's called blooding in the intelligence world. So I didn't know that. That's what they called it. But it's the desensitizing individuals or an entire society to have appalling levels of bloodshed and carnage. So what does that sound like today? We have that. Video games, movies, entertainment. Like, is it good for a 10-year-old to be playing whatever, Grand Theft Auto or all these games? Could you imagine in the fifth, like, I think it was Psycho, which saw which showed the first murder kind of on a movie. And that was like crazy. And look where we've come today. I mean, it's the gradually of showing people like this violence to make them nonchalant about it. Like, and you know, we know it's a movie, but your brain doesn't know it's a movie. So when you see this stuff happen, like a little kid is watching a PG-13 movie and there is a murder or there's whatever there might be, you don't think that has a lasting impact on the brain? And I'm not trying to sound like one of those like crazy Christian moms of like the 80s, the satanic panic, but it's not good. Definitely not good for a little kid to see this stuff. And also these serial killers have high ranking connections to politicians. Gacy, he was a Democrat in the Chicago Party, met face to face with late First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Bundy was connected to the Republican side. So it's not an R versus D thing. But it's just interesting that they have ties. Larry King, Richard Spence, the guy that ran the call ring in DC. I think I talked about him two episodes ago, but Craig Spence, sorry. So when these cases finally happened, multiple personality disorders skyrocketed 100% during these years. So when the serial killings first started happening in like the 70s, multiple personality disorder reporting and evidence showing these people that had these symptoms exploded. Now, many people would say a response could be, well, they didn't know it existed before that. And I'm sure that's true to a case, to a degree, but this just, the amount of people that suffer from these like mental issues, it's got to be tied to certain, like the old world or before technology, definitely didn't see this explosion of mental illness that these people have ever before. And this was so crazy. Bundy's personality would change, right? Because he has multiple personality disorder. All these quotes talk about how, you know, he's one moment he was a new person, all this stuff like that. But there was multiple examples of this where they would be able, they would say their physical appearance would change like a chameleon. Like his neighbor said, he always looked different. Sometimes he didn't even look like the same person at all. The prosecutor, Bundy could be so many different people at once. His muscle tone would change. He would start emitting an odor. And the judge even compared to what it was said about Manson. He said, Charlie Manson was the same way. It was a similar phenomenon. So what does that mean? Does that mean that these personalities could possibly trigger like an actual reaction in our human, in the physical body, that muscle tone changes, your face changes to, you know, obviously, guys, he's not like turning into a redhead or whatever, but clearly there's enough that people are making comments, because that does sound insane. Even if you're saying that, like, wow, he does it sometimes, he looks totally different. But yes, anyway, so the pattern. Yes, I agree, Carl. So Kenneth Bianchi, this was the first guy. So this is Kenneth here. Let me see what my second photo is. Oh, all right. So Kenneth, he was the son of an alcoholic teenage prostitute born in 1951, privately adopted. Those parents were also, you know, he didn't get a better life because of that. We'll say they were reported continually for cruelty to children. They would hold his hand over an open flame for punishment. Crazy, crazy. Killed a cat on Halloween. He would often have gaps in his memory for long periods of time. So already we're like seeing the setup of MPD. Eventually he moves to the great state of California, to Hollywood, starts using and selling drugs. Again, the pattern that I just said always exists. It's always there. And he actually shares an office with an actual psychiatrist. Now, I didn't look who that psychiatrist was. I would have a bet if we dug into who that was, if we were able to, I'd imagine he's probably getting some funding from probably like a shell company to maintain his relations with Kenneth Bianchi. I'm saying the CIA for anyone not picking up my wording, but this was insane. He would routinely go to the hospital for outpatient cancer treatments. His girlfriend would drive in there and he would say, okay, hey, wait in the car until I get back. But he never had cancer, but he was getting some type of treatment because he had receipts and medical forms. So what was he doing in the hospital every month for his girlfriend to drive him there? For, as she said, she would be there like a few hours waiting for him to get back. And so in my mind, that to me says he's clearly either meeting someone there, he doesn't have cancer and he's saying cancer treatments, or they are maintaining that MPD that he has with whatever methods they use. And if you say, well, a hospital would never do that, dude, every hospital, Stanford, the one in Canada, it's like Mick something, they all ran MK Ultra studies on unknowing, unwitting participants. So all it takes is a few people getting money and they will do horrible things to their fellow humans. So Ken's cousin, Angela Buono, let me see. Ugh, I try to make a slideshow and now I don't even know. All right, here's the two, I think. Ugh, I should have labeled it. Jeez, I'm sorry, everyone. But Angelo, his mom was also a prostitute. And according to Buono, she was a prostitute. But he would drive brand new Cadillacs all the time. But he had no job. How does somebody drive brand new Cadillacs with no job? He's married two underage girls, fathered eight kids. He did horrible things to all of them, and he lived with Bianchi. So they both ran this upholstery business, which was a front for a prostitution ring. But this is another similar thing we see over and over again with these guys. They have unlimited funds, seemingly. All of them, Bundy, all of them, Manson, they come out with money. And now, again, when I came out of my troubling times in the facilities, I had no money. So how are these people getting out of jail, where maybe you have a job in jail, you get like pennies, but yet these guys are able to come out, they're able to drive brand new cars, they're able to start businesses, which we're going to see all the time. It doesn't make any sense. What do they have, a rich uncle that just died and they gave him all this money? No. So the upholstery business that was a front supplied the city's business people and a political elite police chief with services, as you can imagine. They were so tightly associated with the police. They let Bianchi display an LA County seal on his Cadillac. He hung out with Sinatra, mafiosos. So these guys were bigwigs of California or Hollywood. They're popular. They've got power, but and we'll see what happens to them. Right. We'll see. They also loved guns and they loved Polaroid pictures. And I'm sure those Polaroid pictures were bird watching. Maybe the many scenes and nice scenery in California was what they were using for them. But their first victim was a black prostitute and a drug dealer. Then two other prostitutes that had both known the first victim. The two witnesses to the attacks, one was a professional hypnotist. The other was a bounty hunter who said he knew the attackers. He saw the attackers getting into a limousine. And no, not the Cadillacs that the cousins were so fond of, a limousine. More attacks, all attributed to the cousins. And I'm saying this about these witnesses' statements making no sense, that they don't tie back to the actual alleged serial killers, because they never do. The witnesses' statements never match. They're never the same person. It's always like a totally opposite witness report. But yet they use these. They will probably call back the witness again. They'll get them to make, you know, change their statement. They know this is the guy. Hey, can you help us out? I know that you originally said you saw this guy with dark hair, but he has blonde hair. We know it's him. And most people in this time for sure would do that, because they don't want to be the reason why a killer walks free. You can imagine what the police would say. They'd be very convincing to you if you are a normal person and you saw a horrible crime. But so the lead investigator, Bob Grogan, who suppressed information, was a technical advisor on TV shows, had connections to Santa Monica Rand Corporation, which is a CIA front. More killings. He gets involved. He becomes the lead investigator. More killings happen. One was picked up right next to Scientology Manor. And if you didn't listen to last episode, Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, Jack Parsons, their theosophy, Freemasonry, cult groups. And what do we say about the cults? Their leader, usually sponsored, paid for, supported by your tax dollars, my tax dollars, and our lovely government agencies. There was three witnesses to this killing across from the Scientology Manor. The one witness was literally questioned over 100 times by Grogan. And the one who saw it from her window, this was insane. So the one, they got it out of their window. They saw it. They're a great witness. They saw it. After the event, they were so good, such a good witness, so good. Grogan had to go to their house and just lopped off all their hedges, because at the time they wouldn't have been able to see through the window because the shrubbery blocked the window. So you couldn't even see in, nor could you see out of the window. So Grogan, he went over there and he did a little landscaping and made sure that witness was more credible that way. Forensics. Well, they have forensics. That should prove that Bianchi and Buono both were the serial killers of all these cases, right? Well, no. Forensic indicated a culprit that wasn't the cousins. The state, the state, the wonderful state of California said, No, that's not human DNA. No. That is ant residue. That's why it's not coming up. It's ant residue. And I'm not joking. That's literally what they said. They said that forensic, it got contaminated by ants. And then Bianchi's confessions were all inconsistent with what actually happened, which is, again, the same story. But regardless, the police make this huge task force. Room 832 of the Justice Building. They are serious. They got whiteboards. They got red yarn. They got Sharpies. They got thumbtacks. And they got pictures. And they're going to solve this case. This room had a lot of good feng shui in the room, if you will. It was used to be a courtroom. You know, so a lot of people were prosecuted, given justice. You know whose case was in this room? The room that became the Bianchi Task Force? Charlie Manson was convicted in this courtroom. courtroom 832 of the Justice Building. The team was led by a Frank Salerno. Frank, also the same that arrested Charlie Manson on drug charges. Also on the team was Grogan, of course, the evidence tamperer. So they got an all-star cast, baby. They can pin anything on anybody. You just better not be the one. Because if your name gets pulled out of the hat, these two guys, they'll make it stick. They'll make it stick. All the victims that were raped never had matching DNA with the cousins. Small issue. They know it's them. They know it's them, guys. I know what you're thinking. They know it's them. Just let it go. They're trying to help us. So it's time to call in the expert, Dr. Jolly West. So now, Jolly West, for those of you who don't know, he is another character of the CIA that is rather disgusting. He was involved with Timothy Leary, LSD, MK Ultra, JFK murder. He was a guy that's probably got more secrets than a lot of people in this world. He would meet with Manson regularly back at the Hate. He had a free clinic that he was running there. Also at that time, Manson was somehow, having unlimited supply of drugs, which is weird, right? I mean, I'm sure there was no connection between him, Jolly West, and Manson. He was also the first guy to promote this mass suicide theory to explain what happened at Jonestown, which if you listen to my last episode or maybe two episodes ago, that's not what happened at Jonestown. Like a small handful died from cyanide poisoning. The rest died from strangulation, execution, stabbings. And I think Henry Lee Lucas was also there at Jonestown. But yeah, Jolly West, Carl says, massive scumbag. Yeah, horrible guy. There was also this story, and I'm going to butcher it a little bit. I have it in my one episode. But Jolly, so he does, LSD studies on people, MK Ultra studies. And there's this guy in the Air Force. And he's on the base, and he wakes up, the Air Force guy, like naked in a ditch with blood all over him. And so he walks like a diner, something like that. He walks off base. So they call the police. Jolly West shows up. He's just so lucky to be driving by. And this guy didn't remember Jolly, but basically the moral of the story is Jolly messed with his brain through LSD and all these things like that. He got him either to cover up a crime and he just was the patsy, or he manipulated this man's brain. I mean, this guy though is just horrible. He's a horrible person, horrible guy. And he just would say whatever they wanted him to say to continue his funding. He would do whatever he had to do to torture people. You name it, Jolly West did it. So look him up. He is a real character, a POS. And okay. All right. So regardless, I got off a little tangent on Jolly West because I hate that guy. But Bianchi, he left LA to Washington, where he joined the Sheriff's Reserves. Who wouldn't want him on the Sheriff's Reserves? Death started occurring in this area as well. So maybe they're associated with him. Bianchi gets caught and he confessed. He was not allowed to have any visitors except some CIA-connected psychiatrists. One was a double hitter. He was an attorney and a psychiatrist. He had ties to the Manson case. Another visitor was Dr. Lundy, who played a pivotal role in other serial killer cases. He was actually just in the area at the time. He dropped in for an off-the-record examination to help them out. He was just, he went on a long drive. He ended up in some rural town in Washington by chance. Bianchi had just confessed. He said, "Hey, why not? I'll help you guys out. Maybe I can find something out for you." Eventually the cousin's house in LA gets searched. Not a single fingerprint in the entire house. Now, how did that happen? There's not a single fingerprint. These two live there and there's not a single fingerprint. What does that mean? Well, that means clearly somebody cleaned the house, scrubbed it, because there's not a single fingerprint in the house. Why would that happen? Because clearly there's been other people there that they don't want their fingerprints being shown that they were there. It's not like Bianchi and Buono knew they were going to get raided and they clean the fingerprints of their own house. That doesn't make any sense. Like, why would they clearly live there? What do you mean? But anyway, Dr. Lunde, his role was to build the prosecution's case to try Bianchi in LA. And there was four distinct personalities that Bianchi had. As well, with all these serial killer cases, everyone, Bianchi enters into a guilty plea. And a lot of them, as we're going to find out, they'll enter a guilty plea. And then once they probably regain some, because they're probably so put on a thiazide, what's that, thormine? One of those antipsychotics they used to put on people in mental hospitals that would make them like catatonic. Probably once they come out of that a little bit, they're like, what am I doing? I didn't do this. Why am I accepting the guilty plea? And just like all these cases, the state's evidence was lacking. It was all on fiber and hair evidence. Fiber and hair evidence, which sound pretty conclusive, pretty easy to place anywhere. When we've clearly already shown that we have crooked investigators, crooked psychiatrists, crooked everybody. You can see how easy it would be to plant a hair or a fiber on a crime scene. Bianchi testified against his cousin for a life sentence. This is what his plea deal was. So you normally take a plea, as you guys all know, I'm not trying to insult you, but just in case, you take a plea deal when, if you don't take the plea deal and you're going to take it to jury or to a trial, you will be punished at the fullest extent of the law. You take a plea deal and you just admit your wrongdoing. You get usually like a lesser charge or a lesser crime. And so a lot of people do that are either definitely guilty or they don't want to risk. You know, they'll do 3 years as opposed to 15 kind of thing. So Bianchi said he was going to testify against his cousin in exchange for a life sentence. So not too good there. And he still might receive the death penalty. So he gained literally nothing from his plea deal. Why would he do that? These guys, they're smart enough to wipe their house down of fingerprints. They're smart enough to remain uncaught for, you know, dozens of murders, but yet he can't figure out how a plea deal works. Okay, right. His attorney also gave him wonderful advice. He told Bianchi, listen, son, I want you to stare in your hands all night and repeat this after me. These hands have killed before entering the court and all night. And he repeated it like a brainwashed person would. He repeated it all day from that meeting till court the next day. And he did not back out over his guilty plea, because we'll have a few examples here of people that back out of their guilty pleas. But could you imagine, like, these people, they have multiple personalities. They can't remit. They have huge blanks and gaps in time. And I'm not saying these people didn't do horrible things. They absolutely did. All of them, most of them, they did horrible things, but they weren't the only ones, and they can't remember what they did, and they come from abuse and trauma, so they're manipulated, their mind, and these people, intelligence, people high up, throw everything on them, and they take all the blame. They think they are the devil incarnate, when really, they probably have such little control over their actions because they don't know what they're doing. And I'm not saying all of these guys, they're not angels by any sense. They're not saints. They're horrible people. But what's even more horrible is to let them take the fall when even more dangerous people go free. Sorry, I gotta take a sip. A month later, he began saying he was innocent. At the same time, their home was also bulldozed by the neighbor. The cousin's home was bulldozed while they're in trial. Now, why would the neighbor accidentally, he said it was a mistake. He didn't mean to bulldoze the house. It was a mistake. You know, I've made many mistakes in my life. I've never bulldozed somebody's house mistakenly. Why would he bulldoze the house? Well, because he's destroying evidence at behest of somebody. And he probably got paid a lump sum to do it. And he did it. And he said, mea culpa, I am sorry. I did not mean to bulldoze the murderer's house. The state was about to drop the case against Bruno because they had no evidence. But the judge, who attended a prep school that was started by the League of Nations, it was basically like an intelligence minor league farm system where, you know, you go here, you go to the CIA. He kept that case alive. The confessions of Bianchi, which were emotionless, zero affect, were not allowed. Okay, so Bianchi made, this is huge. Bianchi made confessions previously to this case. They were not allowed, not admissible in court because it was a different, whatever, different, you know, law. I don't know. Makes no sense, but they weren't admissible in court. So they weren't going to, they have nothing. They have fiber and hair. They have nothing on the case. No evidence. The house been bulldozed, no DNA, no forensics that match. But you know what happens? His lawyer, the one that said, Staren, these hands have killed, the defense, his lawyer brings the confessions into the case. Thus, they were now allowed to be used. The state had nothing on these two guys. And his defense brought in the confessions that were inadmissible. And when they, I guess, you know, because of law, that means now that the prosecution can use this. Insane, right? Insane. Both convicted, guilty in 84. Jury wasn't sequestered. They were sequestered the last year of the trial, not the first 2 years of the trial, because that makes sense. That makes sense. And I'm sure the media that was bombarding the news of where this jury resided was very honest and showing innocent until proven guilty. I'm sure they didn't paint him as this horrid monster for 2 years during the trial. And then they sequester him at the end. Like, it's comical, dude. It's so, and this is going to be the same pattern. So again, are they innocent? No, that is not what I'm trying to tell you at all. I don't know enough about these cases to like say, you know, but they're not innocent. No, they're not innocent, but there are others involved. The judge was upgraded to superior court, hung out with Reagan prosecutors. They got promotions. The defense, he got a promotion or whatever. And Bianchi maintained that he had an accomplice named Greg. Police knew about him. All these things. Greg, this guy that the police knew about were watching, what happens to him? Oh, dude, he was riding a motorcycle. Freak things happen. He died. He died. He died. So first, before I continue, I got a shout out this episode's sponsor. So today's episode is brought to you by Ohio Hauntings and Legends Podcast. So this podcast, it's all about, here, I'll just play the intro.
Welcome to the Ohio Hauntings and Legends Podcast. We will be taking you to places you have never dreamt of going. Hundreds, if not thousands, of haunted and abandoned locations. We will visit with the paranormal from your nightmares and try to understand the unexplained. Ohio alone has 88 counties within our state, and virtually each one of those counties has a story to tell. Ohio's history is bloodstained throughout its history. We will be covering more than just Ohio. We will cover the state you live in, the country. Trust me. There are thrills, chills, and we are upping the fright factor with each new stop we make. We will be traveling the world, the globe, looking for the strange, the mysterious, and the frightening. Mostly, we will find the unexplainable. Many of these episodes are genuine, others are legend or hearsay. Believe those that you choose, or believe in none. It is your choice. Just get comfortable, sit back, dim the lights, and listen.
Dude, I have to say that is an awesome intro, but go listen to this guy, these guys' podcast. It's and their website is ohiohl.com. And again, that podcast is Ohio Hauntings and Legends Podcast. And I always say this to everybody before we get into John Wayne Gacy, the clown, which is, but let me just finish this ad. We waste our time watching these stupid Netflix shows. We watch stupid Amazon Prime propaganda that is just bombarding our brains with like nonsense. And I'm the first one to say we all need an outlet. We all need a hobby. And so the best way to do this, guys, is to use your energy with people who love what they do. Like, I love doing this. People on Netflix, they are trying to put their opinions on you and all these things, these huge MSM resources. So go listen to other stuff. Find, you can find a new hobby and make it a habit and break out of this stupid being stuck in a MSM world. So again, go follow these guys, go listen to their podcast, Ohio Hauntings and Legends Podcast. All right, now back to John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy, here he is. If you're listening, I just have a slideshow up, but his picture, this is some of his artwork. So John, common theme, born son of abusive alcoholic father, shot the family dog, worked in a mortuary as an ambulance attendant. He would sleep in the embalming room with the corpses. Very nice. Very nice. And he was fired after he was found out undressing them. Clearly someone's a little messed up, right? He's deranged. There's something wrong with him. He hung out with this. I was meant to look this up before I did this. This J-A-Y-C-E chapter. Should we just look it up? He hung out with the J-C chapter. I don't know what that is. And I'm sure someone listening is like, it's the United States Junior Chamber. It's a leadership and training and civic organization for people between the ages of 18 and 40. So I think it's like develop young people to go into politics. Probably. They probably do it anyway. So he was fired. He hung out with the JCs. But anyway, he moves to Iowa, opens 4 restaurants because anybody who sleeping in a embalming room at a morgue has enough to open 4 restaurants, enough capital. Of course they do. Why wouldn't he have that much money? Then he opens up a clothing design firm. Again, why wouldn't he have all that money? That makes sense to me. It's not like it's hard to get a business loan in America. It's not like it's, you know, I can't think of any more metaphors. Isn't that insane, dude? Because I work for a small business that it's hard. You could get, you need $150,000 to get a silly degree from college. Of course, sign right here. You have no capital, sign right here. We'll give it to you. But if you want, as a small business, try to get out, we do like $20 million in, you know, whatever, like business a year. And it's almost impossible for us to get a loan. Like our system is so broken, dude. But anyway, he opens up a design firm, opens up a motel. Motels are always classy, always good stuff going on there. And the JC chapter that he was hanging out with involved prostitution, pornography, drugs. And the motel obviously was a front. It would hire young people of both genders. Lots of drugs and alcohol were located on premise, as always. Also, Gacy would swap his wife out with whoever he wanted to. And we see this theme, L. Ron Hubbard, Jack Parsons, wife swapped, John Dee and Edward Kelly from the 1500s would do that, which was unheard of. They were the people that created the Enochian language. So there's something with this wife swapping thing. I've asked people in their opinions. I think the most good answer would be that this wife swapping, it's just such a slap in the face to like God and to the Bible. It's just so degenerate that's why they do it, because it's like up, you know, it's like a scorecard that's like worth 8 points doing something like that. So he took a guilty plea, got 10 years, served two. That's normal. Served 2 years after a 10-year for getting charged with all the gambling, prostitute, all that stuff. In prison, John Wayne Gacy had money for cigars. He had civilian t-shirts. In jail, as everyone knows, you have like a scrubs kind of outfit. He was wearing regular people clothes, cigars, which probably cigarettes were probably still around in jail at that point. Obviously not anymore. That's like a very big commodity. Once a pack of cigarettes goes for like $100, like a Newport 100s. But all difficult commodities, got some good electroshock therapy while he was in prison, some good treatment to help him get better. That always works. You're struggling, get electroshock therapy. It'll help. it'll help. It's a joke. It's a joke. 8 months after being released, he gets arrested again. Oh, he's on parole. He gets arrested. He should go. He's going back to jail, right? No, no jail, no jail. Gets arrested again. This time he handcuffed a young police officer and clubbed him, struck him with his car. He's going to jail, right? Nope. Charges dropped. His fingerprint on file with the local police was labeled Colonel Gacy. So again, we see this with Manson. We see this over and over. Why? There is some reason why these guys are not being charged with crimes after they commit, when they get out of prison or on parole. I had to call every single day the phone number when I was on probation, not even on parole, probation. I had to call this phone number every day, and it would tell me if I had to show up and go do a drug test every day. And like, I had to go on holidays. I had to go on, you know, Memorial Day. I couldn't leave the state. If I did any of these things, if I, like one time I missed one, I had to do that, like caused me to do 3 more months of it. So if you do this, like these people, this doesn't make any sense, is what I'm saying. First missing victim was this worker who did a reconstruction of what else? Drug stores, pharmacies. He went missing. His family gets a call from Puerto Rico saying, hey, your son's with us. We're having a great time here in Puerto Rico. You don't need to worry about him. He just didn't want to see you. He's on vacation. And they're hoping, they're doing that, so they hope that his parents don't report. Boys and young men continue to disappear, all considered runaways by police. Still on parole, Gacy gets charged with deviant sexual conduct. That felony gets dropped. He was knocked out with, he knocks out a guy with a rag placed over his mouth in the gay district where the crime occurred. Gacy was known as a cop in this area. Still nothing happened. He's faking being a police officer. He's knocking people out. He's handcuffing them. All these things. He's on parole. Like, I don't know how many times I can say that's insane. That is insanity. That would not happen ever unless there's somebody powerful watching out for him. Gacy was an aide to the Chicago mayor, Democrats, obviously, but party precinct captain of that group. He's friendly with the Illinois AG, Attorney General William Scott. He was friends with an anchor guy, friends with him as well, like a guy on the TV. So weird. What ties all those three different people? News, politics, killing. What is connecting them? Yeah, I also mentioned that meeting with the first lady. It was signed, best wishes to John Gacy. He was also wearing a Secret Service pin. It has an S, given to high-level security clearance. That's the only people that get it, high-level security clearance. How did he get it? What? It makes no sense. To his second item on his, and on his police report, like that you're able to access with Freedom of Information Act, half of it's all blacked out, indicating that means it's FBI or like CIA matters. National security. He has mob connections. In Chicago, he would entertain as clowns at hospitals. Those are all his victims. So this is artwork again by John Wayne Gacy. And for anyone listening, it's the seven dwarves with a clown figure. So he would entertain as a clown at hospitals, orphanages, and private parties. Now, I'm taking a quick side turn for real quick. But there's something with clowns that I did like a short, go check out my Instagram, but there's this one guy's theory that clowns, there, you know, that there's this innate fear of clowns. Well, for most people, I mean, I don't look at a clown and I'm not terrified, but I don't look at them and say, oh my God, I would love to see a party with clowns. No one says that, but there's this innate with children. They're afraid. But this guy's theory is basically that, like, there's these, you can look at Google. What does Joe Rogan love to take? Oh my God. DMT, when they go, like how Alex Jones talks about the machine elves, but there's this other phenomenon that happens where they see clowns and these clowns communicate, blah, blah, blah. Some people can see through them. Some think they're kind. And these clowns, they in the Hopi Indian tribe of Western, New Mexico, all that kind of Arizona, their gods were clowns. One of their gods was these clowns. They would dress up with stripes, just like how this picture is right here with black, white, and then little red hair at the top. And there's another tribe all the way in the very tippy south, south of South America. They had the same kind of god. So this guy's theory is that clowns are Nephilim or demons, and that's how these demons look. And that's why clowns have this innate fear. That's why their faces are painted white, like all these things. And the even when they talk about the gods in some ancient groups, they would say their faces shine bright that you couldn't even look at, shone like the sun. And that's why these clowns have white face. So basically this theory is that the clowns are how we take drugs and you go into these other realms, or you meditate by doing certain rituals and things like that. That's what the demons or Nephilim look like. And I did a video on it. It was short. Go watch it, because it's a crazy theory. But I just found that interesting that John Wayne Gacy loved clowns. He would dress up as a clown. Clearly this guy is has some evil stuff deep inside him, and he's dressing up with clowns. He's painting clowns. Also interesting is he loves Disney characters. So a serial killer loves Disney, and Disney, as we know, has CIA ties. That's how he got his land. He's a Rosicrucian. These Freemasonries, they all do these rituals. What if there's something there with these clowns throughout the world? That clowns were no one would have created a clown and say, that's hilarious. Oh my God. That's so, just look at him. He's hilarious. I think there's something more to that tradition. Okay. Focus 100% on Gacy. The owner of the pharmacy. So remember, the guy went missing, the young man, they said he was in Puerto Rico, blah, blah, blah. And the owner of the pharmacy refused to give Gacy's address. He refused to answer any questions. Shockingly, weirdly, the owner of the pharmacy and many friends with that boy are at the pharmacy the night before he went missing until 1 a.m. They were counting pills. That's what they were doing. Stocking the shelves, making sure it's all there, doing inventory. That's what they were doing. You know, 50-year-old men are hanging around at a pharmacy until 1 a.m. I'm sure they're not doing anything weird. Sure. I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it. Police agreed due to threats of the boy's family, because they're like, you're not doing anything to help find our kid. We're going to go to the papers, or we're going to scream from the mountain, help us find our kid. So they say, all right, you're right. It's time. Delta unit. They call in, they make a Delta unit, and that should get them, right? They're going to have all the resources, SWAT, except the troubling part about the Delta unit was that Gacy would go out to eat with these guys. He would invite them into his home. He would do ride-alongs with his watchers or his pursuers or the police that were observing him. Other times, they were buddies, guys. They were buddies. He would drive over 100 miles per hour around town through a school zone just to do a fun chase with his pursuers behind him, the Delta unit. You know, driving around, laughing, probably mooning each other in the car, you know, having a lot of fun. He never gets stopped, never gets ticketed, never gets arrested. It's quite an interesting unit, wouldn't you say? House search, meticulously neat, just like Bueno and Bianchi. They did find, though, in Gacy's house, a high school ring belonging to one of the missing boys, an Illinois driver's license of another missing boy, rolling papers, vast supply of pharmaceuticals, handcuffs, police badges. He's a clown. He's playing around. Syringes, a photo lab receipt of the missing pharmaceutical boy, chloroform, because who doesn't have that in their house? Bloodstained rug, ketchup. One room was completely filled with clown pictures, and underneath the house, people had dug trenches covered with lime. I don't imagine limes. I think there's like lime, like the powder. that's helpful in decomposing bodies. 30 of them were buried down there. More had been dumped 65 miles away from the house. Police, okay, he's caught, right? He's hit. He's done. They opted not to arrest Gacy at that time of the search, despite reports from 5 assault victims in Chicago alone, including torture. They didn't arrest him. Oh, gosh. It's just crazy, right? Like, what? So there's something here. The eve of the winter solstice, Gacy was arrested for murder. I'm joking. It's not murder. He gets arrested for the other big M, marijuana. The devil's lettuce. And this arrest caused a second search in which the bodies in his crawl space were amazingly discovered. Not before. They didn't see it before. The surveillance team that was following him going into his house, you know, didn't smell the death that was reeking from his under his floorboards. There were, what did I say, 30 buried under there. They didn't smell it all the times they've been following him. I don't believe that. Either these guys are the dumbest, stupidest people in the world, or they're complicit. And they're allowing something to go because they're being told what to do. Let me see what my next picture has. Here's another Gacy photo for everyone watching or listening. It's the 7 dwarves like walking. Just another Disney scene. And this is the Gacy house where he had 30 bodies buried under the floorboards with a Delta surveillance unit team that never, they were shocked. They were shocked to find out. The garage freezer had unmarked frozen meat, containers full of blood. Later, police claimed that was stewed tomatoes and just a spoiled ground beef. I'm literally not exaggerating. They literally said the containers that was full of blood and the freezer that was full of unmarked meat was stewed tomatoes and just a weird ground beef. Pretty scary when the detectives, the homicide detectives, can't tell the difference between a stewed tomato and human blood. Pretty nervous. I would be, you know, not too confident in their ability to solve many crimes. During the search, he went to the hospital for chest pains and then he confessed to the crimes. The first question was to police from Gacy. Who else do you have at the station? There are others involved. Then he was asked directly or indirectly. He said directly. When asked about the missing pharmacy boy, he said, I don't know. I didn't transport him. I can't say. And of course, because probably the cops that had him there were probably not in on it, trying to solve what they thought was this horrible, you know, what this guy was doing to these people, horrible things. And so they're finding out that he's talking about other people. He's talking about that it's a group of them. And then the interrogation gets cut short by a Sergeant Long. And then Gacy had 2 attorneys, no mention of further associates. Weirdly, the murder rate in Chicago soared after Gacy's arrest. AKA, what does that mean? Does that mean Gacy was killing from behind the bars? No. What it means, most likely, is that there was a lot of witnesses and a lot of loose ends that had to be tied up because they're about to sell this as this single guy killed, you know, whatever, 100 people, whatever it is. And he claimed all the victims. Now, Gacy, he says, all my victims were strangled. These inconsistencies, 13 of them were not. Incorrect locations. He said he had no memory of 28 of the killings. Now, could you say he's lying? Absolutely. It could be. Yeah. He's a murderer. Could he lie? Yeah, absolutely. But he's already screwed. Why would he say no? Most of these guys, they suffer probably from like this, that obviously they suffer from NPD, but they probably have like narcissistic tendencies, and Gacy had no, he didn't admit to them. In jail, he was kept isolated, no contact with jail personnel or anyone. Gacy wrote in like a paper or whatever, since the dark shadow of Satan has come over me, it seems that my fair weather friends have run away. Again, there is more people involved in these horrible things than the one patsy they put it all on. Gacy, again, he confessed to the murders of many young males through a handcuff trick. And this handcuff trick was supposedly he could like put it on his wrist, take it off, and then he would handcuff them. Okay, maybe you get a few people like that. Maybe they're like sitting in the car. He says, hey, you want to see a trick? Look at this. Whoa, you want to try? Yeah. But if anybody, a man that I know or don't know, if even my best friend said, hey, try, look at this handcuff trick. Can I put them on you? I would not let anyone put handcuffs on me because that's weird. Okay. But anyway, that was how he got all of his victims, supposedly. And not maybe there was a group and they overpowered one person, but the handcuff trick, that's what did it. In 1979, Gacy entered a non-guilty plea to 7 more murders. Gacy was super unhappy with his legal team. He wrote to the judge, I asked my trial to be stopped and I haven't heard from you. When I asked my attorney why not we weren't presenting more witnesses, they told me that we don't have the money to bring in experts. The state was able, and a similar repeating pattern, the state was able to bring in tons of evidence that was previously inadmissible because of mistakes, air quote, mistakes made by Gacy's legal team that they opened. Example, they were able to bring in alleged witnesses that survived Gacy's attacks, all told, which weren't allowed previously. Because they were hotshot attorneys. Even public defenders couldn't be that effing stupid if they actually wanted to get an honest trial. All the victims aid solely by Gacy. They told similar stories of druggings and tortures. All victims said it was solely Gacy. Weird, because it was just Gacy who did the crime, which is odd because he killed 33 victims, but these ones he just released, they escaped. Somebody who was so sure to finish these people, he allowed them to escape. But yet one of the most deranged, we are told that serial killers are like slaves to their desires. They're like robot, possessed robots. Once they stop, they cannot stop their actions. But yet one of the most deranged and successful serial killers would torture his victims on end and then pull back and say, hey, thanks a lot. Get down, hit the road, Jack. Get on out here. Get on out. What if Gacy wasn't alone and his house was just a convenient place to leave the bodies? One victim told how when he first came forward to police, they would not allow him to sign any complaints and was informed no action would be taken. A guy that had these interactions with Gacy. This was insane too. So Gacy's alternative personality, as they all have, was he called him Jack Hanley. And basically this witness, the prosecution brought on a James Hanley to the stand to rebut that Gacy is just pretending to have multiple personality disorder. He doesn't actually have it. He's basing this personality off of James Hanley. Why wasn't James brought in earlier? So Jack Hanley is Gacy's alter personality. James Hanley is a real person. They said they were looking for James forever because they knew it was him. They were about, he was pretending off of this action, which is weird. It took them over 2 years to find James Hanley to bring him to court. Where was he? Well, you know, it was difficult to find. He was a detective with the Chicago Police Department since the late 1960s. So he's been a police officer for 20, 30 years. I imagine he's in the system, but they just couldn't find him. That's what took so long. Jury said guilty in less than 2 hours with a death penalty. While sitting awaiting his death, he painted the clowns and Disney figures, which were, like I said, the common theme of many serial killers. I showed these photos. And again, I say this because I'm like, it sounds like I'm defending this Gacy. No. I am sure it is clear that he is involved with abductions, murders, but again, it is super, almost astronomically unlikely that he was acting alone, that he was able to overpower countless young men. And one of the Gacy's victims, Rick Johnson, his family was convinced that he was abducted by the Moon Unification Church organization, which is essentially, you guys, Reverend Mooney, he's a big, like, Trump would just did like a while ago, did like a seminar with them. He's since passed away, but they're South Korean and they're in ties to the South Korean CIA. It's funded by the Reverend Mooney's church. He owns the Washington Examiner, or his family does. He's just like a John Birch society, like a right wing John Grisham. He would talk about how powerful the Moonies is. And Odd Man has an episode, so go check it out. But he's like, they prop him up. He has lots of money. He funds whatever the CIA or South Korean CIA tells him to fund. But yeah, his family's almost worth $1 billion, Reverend Mooney. So the one victim, like I said, his fan, Rick Johnson, his family said that it was that church who kidnapped him and abducted him. And so they just blame that on Gacy. Regardless, Gacy was put to death in 1994. All right, we're going to do Ted Bundy next. And we're almost done here. I hope everyone's having a good time. Let me see what page I'm on in my notes. Well, whatever. So regardless, Theodore Robert Bundy, let's get a picture up. I remember I saw like bits and pieces of that one with, what is it, Zac Efron. And I know like there's like Bundy mania at times, but let's find out about Ted Bundy. Another strange parentage. He entered this world at Elizabeth Lund Home for Unwed Mothers and was abandoned by his mom. He was raised to believe his mother's father, Sam, was his father, which he actually probably was his father. So his father committed incest with his mom and his mom had him. Just so you know, lots of Bundy history is written by Anne Rule, who we're going to get to in a little bit. And Anne Rule looks like a crazy cat lady, but Anne Rule, we'll get into her. So Bundy described his granddad and dad in glowing detail, while other family members said they were sadistic to animals. Ted's mom changed her name, married a Navy man, Bundy, who was employed at a military hospital. Bundy also was a very powerful family. The Bundy family was in politics with JFK and Dulles. And I don't know what direct relation they have. Obviously, there's some relation. It's a huge, you know, very common last name, but yeah. So Ted attends my favorite guy in the world, President Woodrow Wilson's high school in Tacoma, Washington. But at least his former classmates, he claimed Woodrow Wilson High School. Because weird enough, you can't verify it. Why can't you verify it? All of his records from high school have disappeared. Where did they go? Wow. The wind blew away his page only. It's just too much to handle sometimes, guys. It drives me crazy. And nobody cares. Nobody cares. Nobody cares that we're lied to about literally everything. There's nothing that is not a lie. Honestly, they lie about everything. So he goes to Stanford University in the serial killer capital of the world, because why not, studying Chinese studies. Because why not? So he goes to Florida then, and for the Republican National Convention, cheering on one of my favorites, Nelson Rockefeller. He also has a job as a driver/bodyguard for Art Fletcher, who is a candidate for lieutenant governor. So clearly, Bundy's a powerful guy, or becoming one. In 71, he starts working at the Seattle Crisis Clinic, which is, paid work study. His partner, Anne Rule, a policewoman and true crime reporter, whose brother had recently been killed at where else but Stanford University. He also worked as a key organizer of Washington Governor Dan Evans' reelection campaign. You know what his job for the reelection campaign was? To spy and gather intelligence on the governor's opponent. Probably touching a little close to home of where he was actually involved with, the CIA. In 73, he became a special assistant to the Republican Party chairman, and he even babysat his kids. This vicious murderer was babysitting kids. What's not making sense? What's not adding up, right? This serial killers are profiled. They have urges they cannot let go of. They need to act. They're obsessive. All these things. Well, that seems pretty wide open for him to do this. He goes to Cali, then back to Seattle. And when he returns, women start disappearing. Last witness getting into a truck of a man, not Ted Bundy, 2 weeks prior to her body being found. So this girl was seen getting into a car, a truck, that's not what Ted Bundy drove. Her body was missing heart, lungs, liver. Police say it was scavenger animals. These scavengers out here in Seattle, they're very particular. You can look it up. They don't like to scavenge anything that doesn't look, you know, ripe. They don't want a good leg. They want certain organs. That's it. They eat fine out there. So what I'm saying is that's very odd that scavengers only took three organs, or were they taken in a more sinister way? Next girl in 74, supposedly Bundy sneaks into her house undetected by, because it's like a college house. So if you can imagine that. So he sneaks in undetected by the house's three other occupants. He creeps down the stairs, the creaky floor, creeps down there. No one hears a thing. He overpowers the woman, kills her without waking up the roommate that's on the side of a plywood wall. He then, no signs of struggle, by the way, he wraps her body up. Linda was her name, wraps it up, carries it back upstairs. No one hears yet. He then returns creeping, still unnoticed. He makes Linda's bed because that is always important. Hangs up her nightgown, grabs a change of clothes for her. She's dead. And then sneaks out one more time. Her housemates got three calls with just heavy breathing the next day. And one of the roommates went. And then after this, you know, they moved on. One of the roommates went and lived with Ted Bundy's cousin, who Ted Bundy was a huge, very close with since the age of four. They became roommates. What are the odds? The victim was only identified by a single tooth. That's how they identified Linda's body, a single tooth. So you can see it was a skull with a single tooth. So you can see, how do we know that's her? How do we know that, right? Like, are we going to take the honest, forthcoming, these people for their word? I wouldn't. That doesn't sound like, if they had more, they would show it, right? Another victim, Donna Manson. I know. What are the odds? Conspiracy or just a coincidence? Took a week to report missing. She bore no resemblance to the previous girl. Donna also dabbled in occultism as well, like her namesake, Charlie Manson. Ted's friends had been her racquetball partner. Another friend that was taken was Ted's jogging partner of another victim. You see, all these people know each other, and you could maybe make the argument. Well, one, everyone said like, oh, Ted Bundy goes after the same type. He doesn't. He's taken plenty. The media just shows the pictures that all look alike. And then also all these people are connected. They know one another, like 2 degrees of separation. Is that because he's picking off people that is close with, or is it more likely that all of them dabble in unchristian activities and they're suffering from that? They're getting repercussions. And I'm not saying all of his victims were like that. Absolutely not. But it seems to be interesting that a lot of serial killers' victims tend to be drug dealers, tend to interact in this under black market kind of world. And that's usually who is involved in it. And obviously there's exceptions to every rule. In the spring of 74, the Pacific Northwest was grappling with another phenomenon at the time, cattle mutilations. Now, people with conspiracy candy love cattle mutilations with UFOs, Bigfoot, and I don't believe in UFOs, they're demons, and we could have that discussion anytime you want, but I don't know about Bigfoot. I don't really care. It's fun to like talk about, I guess, but I've never seen a Bigfoot. The one guy who filmed the Bigfoot, though, was, oh man, this was in my notes and I didn't bring it up. Whoever filmed that Bigfoot video, his son was either a serial killer or had ties to a serial killer. What are the odds of that, dude? The guy that filmed Bigfoot's kid becomes a murderer. But very few make the suggestion of satanic oh my God, I try not to say that word this whole episode. Jesus, but the cattle mutilations, no one ever questions the occult type of aspect of this. They're specifically taking certain things, et cetera, et cetera. Another missing girl was friends with Ann Rule. Let me see if my next one's Ann Rule. Here's Ann Rule. For anybody listening, Ann Rule has like a perm haircut with a cat and a typewriter. She looks like the biggest dork in the world. And you'll see why I don't like Ann in a second. So another missing girl was friends with Ann Rule's daughter around Greek Road or college. It wasn't well lit. They all saw this girl almost entering the doorway and then disappeared without a trace, noticing nothing. The lead investigator, Herb Swindler, and we're going to get into this, Herb Swindler, just wait, was friends with Ann Rule for 20 years. A summit was held in Oregon. They say, we need to have this conversation about these missing women, which is weird because at the time, there was only one girl's remains that had been discovered. So they were missing, but they weren't deceased. They could have been anywhere. It was before cell phones. Ann Rule, she was also at the summit. She's not a cop per se. Along with the Army's Criminal Investigation Division. Pretty weird that the Army's Criminal Investigation Division is coming to a police summit. Seven girls missing, no forensics, no witnesses, no evidence to even tie them together. Not a single suspect, but yet they're already tying them together. One girl went missing on a crowded lake park in broad daylight. Thousands of witnesses, Seattle police, were having their annual picnic that day. The girl, her dad was a probation officer and a parole board member. No one's, which sending a message or intimidation or blackmail, but no one saw her get into any car. But her bike was missing. Well, they tie her to Ted Bundy and they said, but her bike was gone. Her bike could not fit into his VW bug. That's the picture I have up for people listening. It's a Volkswagen, tiny little bug. Her bike wouldn't have fit. So where did her bike go? Or was it not Ted Bundy who took her? Another one missing that day was a known drug user and babysitter of Ann Rule's children. One witness said the girl was taken from a park via a biker gang, which is interesting. Drugs, again, drugs, cults, serial killers, gangs, mafia. They all have an interesting starting point, usually the CIA. Eight witnesses came forward describing the man at the park with blonde hair that they did see. Only two of them, which Ted Bundy doesn't have blonde hair, only two of them were able to identify Bundy, whose picture was all over the news, tainting any ID. Like, this is the man who's been stealing the girls. This is the man. And originally, still, only two people identified Bundy out of a lineup. They said the man ID'd himself as Ted. Why the stealthy killer who has been able to escape all these missing people, no evidence, no forensic, starts using his real name is beyond me. Why is he going up and telling people, like, as he, you know, that he IDs is Ted? So a new Ted task force was created. It's funny, like Ted talks. I wonder what that means, Ted. There's some deeper meaning. But anyway, a Ted task force was created. And the first person reported, Theodore Bundy, who turned in Ted's name. Because again, at this point, no one knows who it is. There's no real suspects. All they have is Ted. Well, Ann Rule, she says, I know exactly who it is. And fresh from her attendance at that law enforcement summit, the two girls' remains that were found were examined by a Dr. Darius Swindler. Now, I just talked about Herb Swindler. Is Darius Swindler also related? And what did Herb do again? Let's make sure I... Herb Swindler. Oh my gosh. I feel like, what was he, just a cop or something? Why did I already forget this, guys? This is crazy. Oh, whatever. Well, I'll probably repeat what he is. But yes, so now you have a Darius Swindler that's involved with the relation, and he has relations to the previous Swindler. They're both related. Now, Ann Rule's book, who wrote a whole book about the Ted Bundy case, because she's in every aspect of it, totally by accident, I'm sure, totally coincidental. She said that this whole, she said, so people at the time in Seattle were saying these events, is there's a link here between occultism and unchristian activities. Ann Rule made a specific point to mention in her book that those claims are totally ridiculous. They make zero sense. But the Washington Chronicler, a local paper, said occultism and unchristian worship have long found a small but a following group around Seattle. And the guy was even convinced, or this paper or these investigators, that there was an offshoot of the Charles Manson family that had moved to the Seattle era and began a new reign of terror led by Ted. So I found that interesting. Could this cult have split? And last episode, we talked about how like ancient mystery religions to Knights Templar, to Freemasonry, to Theosophy, to OTO, Hermetic Order, they all literally are like, you could do an umbrella from the top. You have the mystery schools and it just splits. And it's all the same beliefs. And New Age gets looped in there. New Age comes from Theosophy. It's all the same stuff. And they just use different vocabulary to entice. They cast a larger net to get more people and remove them away from Jesus and God. And so that's why I'm such an anti-New Age guy. Everyone likes astrology. It's interesting, blah, blah, blah. But do not put faith in it, because just like the clowns you meet on DMT, you play around with that stuff, something reaches back. And that's what's so enticing. Ooh, someone wrote, I saw Ultimate Evil reading through. Oh. So Carl said, reading through Program to Kill and Ultimate Evil and Shadow over Santa Susanna, one will notice a large preponderance of folks with double initial names. Huh. Cops, victims, shrinks. Very interesting. Wild. Very weird. Paid agents, maybe he said. That's really interesting. Let me get focused. I forgot. Oh, Ted moves to Utah. Girls still vanishing in the area. In Utah, girls are dying. One's drained of blood entirely. Another's kept alive for a week after her disappearance. Her makeup, though, was undisturbed. No nails broken, no sign of ligature. Teff left for a hunting trip the day after she was last seen. So clearly it could not have been Ted. And she was the daughter of a police chief in Utah. One police officer even said, Bundy had nothing to do with our cases. See, but they tie them all to him. A few weeks before the one girl died, she randomly said to her mother, at my funeral, please don't bury me in a dress. And she eventually, like weeks later, gets killed by Ted Bundy. You know, just things that are kind of odd, that all these inconsistencies. In 74, here's another case. This Ted Bundy, though, it's like, that's like the biggest one, I feel, or one of them. So he's abducted to abduct two people that night, one from a shopping mall. He fails. So he goes and strikes again outside of school play. And he was allegedly successful there. The issue that comes about with this is that it was physically impossible for Ted or anyone else, the same person, to commit both of those crimes. One witness has described two different perps, one with slick black hair, one with brown, one with alcohol in the breath, one without, different clothes. But to make this work, he would have had to drive his Volkswagen over 100 miles per hour on rain-soaked streets, since crime scenes were 26 miles apart and only 15 minutes elapsed between the events. So impossible. He couldn't have made it there, but yet he's tied to that. Regardless, the Ted squad said, oh, it's the elusive Ted. He's amazing. He's a NASCAR driver. And the arrest of Ted were so bizarre, so bizarre. And this is like this is our last thing. And then I just got conclusions. So I hope you guys are enjoying it. I always worry when I go too long, but he gets stopped by UA Utah Highway Patrol, Bob Hayward, brother of Captain Pete Hayward, chief detective of Salt Lake County Sheriff. His crime, he was driving down a street that took him by the officer's house. Hayward had a bad feeling about him. Randomly, he had a bad feeling. And so five cops showed up for a traffic violation. Now, cops will call in backup all the time, but five cops for a traffic violation? His car gets searched illegally, no consent. In his car, he had a pry bar, a ski mask, a stocking mask, an ice pick, and a pair of handcuffs. And they said the handcuffs were used in a previous murder, but they were different than the ones on the victim's wrist. Nonetheless, Ted was taken into custody. He gets cleared after posting bond. And this is where it gets even crazier. Ted is like El Chapo. Ted meticulously cleans his VW, even with a garden hose, after this first arrest. He made some repairs, then sold his car to a former classmate and one of the victim's brothers. Investigators claim three different victims' hair managed to survive the cleanup effort. But regardless, he moved out of his rooming house under police surveillance, never searched that room for evidence. So they had no evidence linking Ted to the crimes in the state, but they charged him anyway. The attempted abduction that we talked about earlier, the victim was unable to pick Bundy out of a lineup, but he had no problem picking Bundy later on when he was alongside all police officers in the lineup that were all fat. Police replaced the inmates that were scheduled to be in the lineup with cops because they just made a mistake. They just made a mistake. Hey, listen, buddy, you know who it is. Just pick him. Ted is set for trial, and his great attorney at the last minute decides, Ted, let's let the judge decide the fate of you, okay? Instead of going to a risky trial, they might have shaky evidence, but let's not risk it. So the witness, again, could not decide if Ted had a mustache, what color car he drove, and like I said, he couldn't pick him out of a lineup. No matter. The judge saw no issue with that. He got convicted and was allowed no visitors. Well, except one visitor, Ann Rule, our lovely cat lady. Not a relative, not even on the list of approved visitors, showed up on a day that was not a visiting day, wasn't even searched, but yet she was allowed to come in. And the railroading had only just begun for Ted Bundy. Colorado State now put an arrest warrant out for him. Their case was built on a hair that was supposedly found in his car, a gas purchase ticket that put him in the state of Colorado at the time of these disappearances, and a ski county guidebook that was found in Ted's possession. And around the time Bundy's awaiting trial, Carol Ann Boone, who previously worked at a Vietnamese resettlement camp, which is, we'll get to that with Operation Phoenix. She met Ted, would later marry him, bear a child, but Bundy knew the case was weak. He defended himself and the case just fell apart with the evidence that I previously listed. So the state ran with the hair that was found in his car. But Bundy, if he would have stayed, he would have gotten out of the trial. But what happened? He escapes. He was left unguarded at court, jumped out of a window, strolled down the street, found his way to an empty cabin. And, you know, crazy. It's an empty cabin. The cabin, it's stocked with food. Wow. Clothing, a rifle, flashlight, blankets, first aid, almost like everything you need to survive was just stocked in this random cabin after he escaped. And how did he get into the cabin? Well, he used his hands and ripped off the security feature that was on a window that the caretaker said would have taken a huge superhuman strength or power tools. And Ted was able to do it with his bare hands. So what happened here is his case is weak. The state knows the case is weak. Somebody close to Ted, possibly Ann Rule, said, listen, Ted, there's a cabin ready for you. They're going to railroad you like they've been doing this whole time. You need to get out of here. Don't take it to court. And so we're going to let you escape. You escape. This is how. And there you go. So he does it. That's my assumption anyway. Ted gets recaptured and he has this awesome new attorney who's done drug trafficking cases. He's very like flamboyant, very, you know, gregarious and loquacious. How about those words for you? Well, this attorney has a freak accident on a motorcycle. His wife also gets killed on the motorcycle. You guys see these patterns. Ted gets arrested again after the cabin and his flashy attorney's gone. Well, like El Chapo, Ted escapes again. He escapes through climbing through a foot square hole in the ceiling of his cell, which he cut with a hacksaw. Now, a few questions how I would ask how Ted Bundy, one, who's, you know, how do you get a hole in your cell? It's like concrete. Two, how does one get a hacksaw in prison? Who brought Ted Bundy a hacksaw to get out of his cell? Not a single guard heard the sawing that was going on in his goddamn cell. A cellmate didn't say anything. What? That makes zero sense. But yet he was able to hack through a steel plate. Then he scurried over the space above a deputy's apartment, lowered himself down into a closet, hung out, and then strolled out the door to freedom. So he gets out, he finds one of these like snow or like a ATV type thing that has the necessary tires to go in the snow, which just happened. And you know what? Does he need to hotwire the car? No, the keys are already in the ignition. Ted, lucky duck. So he's found a cabin fully stocked, escaped with a hacksaw in prison, found a ride. Well, eventually the vehicle breaks down on the way. But luckily, a GI was driving by, picked him up. Sure, he's in prison outfit. Pick him up. He ends up in Florida, of all places. And we're really at the end here. He eventually gets caught. There's a slaughter that takes place at a sorority house in Florida. And I don't think I mentioned this in my episodes, but this was another crazy Richard Speck. So this was like this. It was like the co-ed slaughter in Chicago. He killed a bunch of nursing students. So like, this is the story. Supposedly there was like 13 girls and he came into their house. He got them all into one room. He set up like the torture room in the other room. And one by one, he would take one, do horrible things for 25 minutes till they died, wash off, get another one. And this is the story. The girl that let him in, surprise, was the only one that survived. And she survived by hiding under the bed, even though others, like she claimed all the girls were trying to do that. But this story makes up like 13 people. There's a pattern that's established after the second girl doesn't come back. They know what's happening. And yet they don't try to break out of their door. They don't try to overpower this guy. They know they're going to die. And the only witness that Richard Speck did this stuff was the one girl that survived. And she performed amazingly on trial, let me tell you. And I'm not saying that this didn't, but clearly these girls did die. My take is probably that she was involved with the group that attacked these girls and was like their mole. So again, these stories just don't make sense. Regardless, Ted in Florida, a girl is drained of blood. Weirdly, he's arrested near Eglin Air Force Base, a restricted military facility. He had tons of ID cards, tons of cash. The one cop who's an honest cop says, "Ted, where did you get the money to travel across the country?" And Ted's quote, "Well, man, there's other people. Other people are in on it." And so again, we have Gacy, we have Ted Bundy, all saying there's other people's involved with it. After that, Ted was put under huge amounts of medication, totally without emotion in court, because they're worried he's going to say too much. The judge gets replaced with a naval guy, and Ted took trial as he claimed innocence. Shockingly, who was one of the jurors? A Vernon swindler. Now that's three swindlers involved with the Bundy case. Conspiracy or just a coincidence? And there was evidence was fabricated all over. All right. So this is the last. So what does this all mean? Right. So this profiling and this fear, it was started in 1972, essentially, the behavioral sciences unit. The FBI just opened up at Quantico. Robert Ressler and John Douglas, they were the big guys. Ressler in 78 coined the term serial term. He was the first to interview Bundy, the last talk to Gacy, held court with Manson, no Sirhan, no Speck, Dahmer. He created this violent criminal apprehension program that Ann Rule pushed for so hard. In VICAP, it's just another thing that problem reaction solution. Like, don't you want us to catch these serial killers? Well, sign your rights away. Give us your freedoms, because what if these monsters are out there? They could be in your neighborhood. It's just waiting. And this guy, his story was like a movie. He grew up in Chicago with none other than John Wayne Gacy. They did Boy Scouts together. And in a Hollywood voice, but these two men, took two different roads. One, a criminal. The other, a cop. That's literally his story. That makes no freaking sense. And, oh, thanks, Chop Ninja. Yeah, I think you'll like them. I thought they're interesting. But yeah, so wrestler, he was friends with John Wayne Gacy growing up, and he becomes the cop that creates behavioral profiling. And the last part of the story, I know I keep saying that, but I got like 5 minutes. So bear, these are big points. In 1945, crime was almost like very low in America, right? We didn't have like, there were no serial killers. But in after World War II ended, everyone came back and Chicago's crime rates skyrocketed. This guy, William Hirons, he would dress in women's clothing as a child. And basically, he killed all these women horribly. He was tortured when caught. Sodium pentothal, deprived food, water, and spinal tap. He was never allowed a lawyer. He ultimately took the fall because he said, I feared for my life. And his fingerprint on the scene matched 9 points. FBI requires 12 points for positive ID. Prints surfaced out of thin air that weren't presented until years later. And in 2002, even The Guardian, that liberal rag, wrote about how this was the grossest miscarriages of justice in the ever. And I told this story because in 1945, with this guy, William Hirons, you have the OSS returning, which becomes the CIA, like Alan Dulles, masters of psychological warfare that have picked up tons of tips and tricks from the Nazi regime, and how you start, how fear can be so beneficial to manipulate a populace. And this is how you start a fear campaign. You tell these lies about these killers that it's a boogeyman. It's a one person monster that's in your neighbor. That could be your neighbor. That could be your, you know, grocery store guy or whatever you want to call it. And that's why this started right after World War II, because they are, as you know, our government loved, Carl. Yeah, you are lucky, Carl. Laugh out loud. Sorry, guys. I try to read and do the, so fear. So they picked up tricks from the Nazis and now created this propaganda boogeyman, evil being that could exist as your neighbor. And the one quote from Jeffrey Dahmer, it's hard for me to believe that a human being could have done what I've done, but I know that I did it. Weird, right? So OSS, they have the first kind of like a mini serial killer after World War II ends. Then we have the Phoenix program. And I've been mentioning the Phoenix program all past three episodes. The Phoenix program was a psychological warfare campaign utilized against the Vietnamese. What did they do to them? Well, basically they would take the worst of the worst of Vietnamese psychos and our military trained psychos, train them in how to kill and set them free and say, do whatever you want. And these people were like, they had these split personalities that they created. They now armed with knowledge of how to be deadly, and they set them free on the Vietnamese people, women, children, innocents slaughtered. And why did they do that? Did they want to hurt? No, what they wanted to do was terrify the Vietnamese. They wanted to scare them so much that they were terrified, that they begged the big bad America to save them because they had these psychos on the loose. And this wasn't just murder they did. They would fly planes and drop, like, they would have like a speaker of like this ghost or whatever that they're like, they're not religion, but they're like cultural norms had at the time, like the cult, the god of death or stuff. And they'd have them chanting over the loudspeaker, dropping pam things, trying to scare these people, all this psychological warfare that they did to these people. And they brought that everywhere. They did it in South America and El Salvador and all these countries. So again, what's the point of all this? So here's the conclusion, right? So clearly, based on these episodes and what I told you about, they attribute all these stuff to these serial killers. Why? Why do they attribute it to one person? Well, it's a double thing. One, they get to get you afraid. So you problem, reaction, solution, you, You're terrified that your neighbors are going to kidnap you and abduct you. So you sign your rights away. Yes, monitor. Keep me safe. Keep me safe. Two, because there is an evil anti-Christian religion that has existed for thousands of years. And if you're not a Christian, well, I can tell you that these evil people, they are the opposite. So that should be give you some help to slowly gain some faith because they believe in it. They believe in the opposite person as we believe in Jesus, right? But they do horrible things. I talked about my first episode, Freud was noticing that he had patients come in, crazy Freud, the cocaine sniffer, would have patients come in and talk about these abuses they suffered at the hands of certain people. He realized that the same things were being said about the witches and the witch trials in Europe and in America, the same types of things involving excrement and blood, et cetera, et cetera. So clearly this is a pattern that has been set, and serial killers were the perfect cover for that. That all these, they were able to outsmart hundreds of people to their demise. So while they steal your rights, you're cheering away them to keep you safe. Back the blue, right? Back the blue, even though they would be the first that would kick down your door if they were told to. And there was one story, guy, he killed somebody. He gets out on parole. They let him walk free. 6 months later, he starts killing again. And this was in Texas. And that was in the early 90s. And people are like, yeah, well, we need stricter penalties. And what are they doing today? Removing cash bail, all that stuff, which is horrible. But to remove that, so then you have the people get out earlier that commit another crime, and that's going to cause the problem. So the problem is going to be more crime because they got released. The reaction is upset. And what's the solution? All, more power to the government's arm, the monopoly they have on violence. So that's it, guys. I think that was all I really wanted to say that was important. Oh, last thing. Serial killers also, the purpose of them, so before them in America, in the 20s, 30s, you know, tens, you had the mafia. You had Al Capone, all these people. The mafia was doing all the contract hits that the government couldn't do because the CIA was allowed to operate because of the, and they were denied for their existence, like saying, no, there's no organized crime in America for 40 years while they were killing, you know, any enemies, anybody they were asked to kill. Well, eventually that's got to stop because now people are hip to it. They know what's going on. So after World War II, they say, let's go a different route. Instead of having a huge group of mafia men, let's just train these guys and let them loose. And these serial killers had tons of contract killings, tons. It wasn't just innocent bystanders. There were specific hits that they went out and did. They're the violent arm of the government. So that's it, guys. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. I know it was a little long today, but basically what you need to know is there's something evil that exists, and the best way to fight back, as I always say, pray, marry, have children, work out, find God, and learn. And that is the best thing you can do. So thanks for my supporters. Darcy, thank you for your donation on Venmo. I have a Venmo if anyone wants to donate at Conspiracy or JAC. All my Patreon supporters, I got an awesome review. If you can't support the show, totally cool. If you could leave a review, I would be honored. Subscribe and rate the show or whatever. And follow me on Instagram, soon to be, not Twitter, wink, wink. But I'm Jack Allen with Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm out. I'll talk to you next week. Peace.